Hi, friends. Gene Valentino from the Grassroots Truthcast. You've got to join us not only for the great shows and entertainment and guests, but you got to join us because our sponsorship is growing. And it would mean a lot to them, not to mention me, if you come on board. And the one we're featuring this week is Luis Sanchez from The Cigar Shop. He owns a company called La Tradición Cubana. The Cigar Shop, Miami, Florida, since 1995. This Luis is really one heck of a guy. He's determined to manufacture cigars based on an unprecedented excellence in quality using old-fashioned Cuban methods. The cigar isn't always cheaper, but it is better. And if, like, you're drinking a fine wine, you got to have a fine cigar, look for Luis Sanchez at The Cigar Shop. He helped me find a nice Connecticut wrapper with a Nicaraguan blend. And this cigar has become not only my enjoyment, but this cigar has also become my brand and my marketing tool. You notice up close, we've got a little label he's put on there for me. And that's my website, genevalentino.com. It's at the Grassroots Truthcast. Now, here's the deal. You go to thecubanshop.com, find the cigar you want, and Luis will throw in the labels for free. But you got to tell him Gene sent you. Tell Luis Gene sent you. The labels are free. These are $50 to $100 values based on the count. And you can get this to become part of your branding experiment. I'm using this with my guests on the Grassroots Truthcasts. This could be your brand on your product, your service, anywhere in the world. Look for Luis Sanchez at thecubanshop.com. Thanks for joining us. Enjoy your smoke. Hi, folks. Gene Valentino, and welcome to another exciting episode of Gene Valentino's Grassroots Truthcast. We try to bring fascinating guests on from around the world every week now, it seems to be. And the one issue that I have stayed away from because I wanted to learn more about it, it can probably most of my questions will be answered by the gentleman to my right. He is Dr. Robert Malone. He's well known worldwide and recognized as a scientist and physician and the original inventor of this mRNA vaccination as a technology, the DNA vaccination and multiple non-viral DNA and RNA and mRNA platform delivery technology. So what did I just say? Well, Dr. Malone's going to help me explain all of this. He holds numerous fundamental domestic and foreign patents in the fields of gene delivery, delivery formulations, and vaccines, including for fundamental DNA and mRNA vaccine technologies. Welcome aboard, Dr. Malone. That's a mouthful. Was I on target there?
Yeah, that and I'm also a human being.
You're with a lovely wife who I met at a recent conference, and someone I would like to get to the folks to get to know too. She's been by your side as my wife has in the successes in life I've enjoyed, and so it'd be nice to have her participate with us in the future. But today, folks, it's Dr. Robert Malone, scientist and patent holder and original fundamental designer of the vaccination for the COVID-19 virus. We're going to get into the specifics on that issue right after this.
8 years ago, we developed and launched the best bed sheets ever. Since then, you've all enjoyed the best sleep of your life. And to thank you all for your support, we're bringing you our bed sheets for the lowest price in MyPillow history. Get our seasonal flannel sheets for 50% off. They're nearly sold out, so get yours today before they're gone. Check out our new Percale line. Queen size only $39.98, king size only $49.98. And our famous Giza Dream bed sheets, queen size originally $139.96, wait on it, now only $59.98. King's just $10 more. So go to MyPillow.com or call the number on your screen. Use your promo code to get huge discounts on all MyPillow bed sheets. And for a limited time, when you order $75 or more, your entire order ships absolutely free. We have very low quantities at these prices, so order now.
Hi, folks. Welcome back to the Grassroots Truthcast. Again, my guest is Dr. Robert Malone. Doctor, save me some narrative and time. Give us the short version of a very comprehensive background you have with medicine.
Well, first, Gene, just to be clear, it was a little bit off your lead in before the break, in that I had no role in designing these vaccines. So I just want to be clear on that. Matter of fact, I spent the first part of the COVID crisis focusing on drug repurposing, because the history of coronavirus vaccines has been one of complete failure in humans. And it was my assessment and belief that it was unlikely that a safe and effective product, highly unlikely that a safe and effective vaccine product could be brought to bear in any kind of a timeline that would matter in terms of mitigating the risk of COVID in the human population. Rather, I focused on drug repurposing, and particularly famotidine, celecoxib, ivermectin, and other agents. I was brought into this whole controversy because I objected to basically the medical ethics of what was going on.
It's funny you mention it that way, and thanks for the clarification. I know what I said, but it may have come out wrong. The fact is, you were tasked with trying to find a solution for COVID-19. Is that true?
Yeah, informally, that's absolutely the case. I was asked by somebody who's very influential in the biodefense enterprise in the United States government to pull together a team and come up with solutions to the potential risk. So that's kind of how this all got kicked off in the beginning of January of 2020. But getting back to your question in terms of the arc of my career, in general, I started off very focused on molecular medicine, and with my degree from Northwestern University, my MD, and my scientific training from UC Davis, UC San Diego, and the Salk Institute, I was really enamored of the idea that I could contribute to particularly pediatric genetic disease by helping to advance gene therapy technology. And it was just a inadvertent spinoff, is the truth of it, of the research that I was doing for my graduate degrees that led me to the discoveries of how to manufacture RNA at scale, how to engineer it so that it could be readily used to produce protein when injected or administered, and how to deliver it using these positively charged fats called cationic lipids, which we now call the lipid nanocomplexes. So having made this series of discoveries and innovations, I confronted the question, what are you going to do about it? What are you going to do with it? Is this useful for anything? And so the insight was that this could be used as an alternative for viral gene therapy. Remember that there was two general types of gene therapy vaccines used in the COVID crisis. One was adenovirus vectors, which is a recombinant virus. It was actually being pioneered in the same lab that I was at the same time, when I was working on RNA at the Salk Institute. So a strange tangle in history. And I was working on retroviral vectors, so engineering retroviruses for gene therapy purposes. And suddenly I found myself giving birth to non-viral gene therapy, which was not very politically appropriate in the particular lab I was in, since my mentor was a virologist. But that's just the nature of science. Sometimes it takes you down a path that you don't expect. After that work at the Salk, I finished my last 2 years of my MD at Northwestern in Chicago, and then returned to UC Davis as a intern in pathology and then as an assistant professor, where I built a gene therapy program of about 8 to 10 people, including other faculty members, and got it funded. Had a big award for development of a vaccine for AIDS and a number of commercial awards for developing this technology, lipid nanoparticles and catenic lipids for delivery purposes, particularly for the research market for companies like Promega and Boehringer Monheim. And then I was recruited. UC Davis decided that there was no future in non-viral gene therapy, which is probably in retrospect not the best decision. And I was recruited to University of Maryland, where I then pioneered the use of pulsed electrical fields to deliver genetic material, including for vaccines. Then moved to the Uniformed Services University of Health Sciences, which is the military medical school in Bethesda, and helped them start a breast cancer genomics research program based in Western Pennsylvania. And then they wanted me to relocate to a small town in Western Pennsylvania, which I and my wife both objected to. So I left that program and was recruited into a whole new area, science and medicine, that was just exploding at the time. I hadn't been involved in it previously, which was this large contract for the Department of Defense for all biodefense products that the U.S. military was taking into what's called advanced development, which is clinical trials and taking through to licensure. So suddenly I found myself right in the middle of the entire biodefense industrial complex as a associate clinical director up in Frederick, Maryland, outside of Fort Detrick. And that's what launched me into the whole biodefense enterprise and the caused me to really change my career focus from discovery research, bench research, to this term advanced development, which is to say the world of how do you take a product through FDA regulations and clinical research through to licensure. And that takes a whole different bag of tricks. And so I spent about a decade learning to be an expert in that area and developed expertise in regulatory affairs, clinical research, project management, and grants and contracts, particularly federal grants and contracts. I've won hundreds of millions of dollars, really about $1 billion, $1.2 billion for my clients in grants and contracts. So that's kind of that turn in my career. And at one point I went private and hung up my shingle as a consultant and spent about 2 decades as a consultant in this area, particularly focused on vaccines, completed another fellowship at Harvard in global clinical research. And I was kind of percolating along, working with a variety of companies and the Department of Defense, particularly serving IH and NIAID as a study section director, typically, or study section chairperson on large grants and contract selection process. And I had been in this role through this whole arc, kind of at the tip of the spear, I think in about 5 different major outbreaks. And so I'm very familiar with pandemic preparedness, pandemic strategies, normal responses to infectious disease outbreaks, et cetera.
You've touched, I'm sorry, keep going.
And I'm pretty well wired into that world when I got a phone call from a gentleman named Dr. Michael Callahan, who holds a Harvard appointment and I guess now is retired CIA, who I had worked with in the past. I'm not CIA. I've never worked for the CIA. I've never worked for DARPA, but he was a professional colleague. And he called me, I'm not sure if it was from Wuhan or as he was about to go to Wuhan, on January 4th of 2020 and alerted me that there was a novel coronavirus and that as I had done with prior outbreaks, I should pull together a team and start working on ways to treat or mitigate the risk of this novel coronavirus that was loose in Wuhan, China. And that's what kind of got me going on this outbreak. And that led to that whole arc of the last 4 years of what I've experienced, in particular, the censorship, encountering the propaganda and misinformation, and objecting to the suspension of accepted norms in clinical research and medical ethics that I've been trained on rigorously, as is anyone who does clinical research. And in so objecting to what was going on, the coercion and compulsion and enticement to get these experimental products, I suddenly found myself on the outside and being attacked for just speaking the, you know, truth and accepted norms, advocating for the accepted norms in terms of protection of human subjects, which is a very odd place to be in.
Yeah, if I may, I'd like to jump in right there and just discuss with you what happened. I just to give you some background, I think we have something in common. There's a group out of Silver Spring, Maryland that I'm invested with, in full disclosure, that went through the creation of a vaccine for the cure for AIDS. But they're going through clinical trials. They're going through a second stage of clinical trials right now, and there might be a third stage to follow. They're going public, and I'm very proud of the procedure behind all of that. What caught my attention in the whole COVID process was the speed at which government released, or I should say allowed to be released, a cure, a vaccination for the cure, alleged cure for COVID-19.
Or prevention. I would say not cure, but prevention.
Yeah. A prevention mechanism of some degree of success that had been allegedly incompletely tested. It had not gone through the clinical trial procedures you know best. And then so my baseline, my focal point was, here I am watching a cure for AIDS go through level one, level two, and maybe level three testing based on FDA's acceptability.
Plus your non-clinical package, right? So you had do animal work and a lot of toxicology, et cetera. So that's the norm, what you just described, which is typically $1 billion and at least a decade.
Of research before released. However, we had an emergency on our hand, a declared emergency. And for the public's knowledge, what I do know is government used its aggressive authority, and in this case, overstep, in allowing the acceleration of this preventative measure to come out faster without having been fully proven. Yes or no?
Correct.
Okay.
I would nuance the wording a little differently. The government actually acts as this. So since you, it's very helpful for me to understand your background. So I can use words like sponsor. You understand that language. Sponsor being the company that seeks approval of a product. In the case of these emergency use authorized products that are marketed to all of us as vaccines, basically by the federal government in conjunction with the manufacturers. I'm drawing a line here between the manufacturers. Usually the manufacturer and the sponsor are the same thing. In the case of these emergency use authorized products, the sponsor is functionally the FDA, or arguably the FDA and the Department of Defense, as opposed to, in your case, the sponsor is a for-profit corporation. You're going to bring which book to my attention there?
Yes, it is. It's publicly known. It's the company's American Gene Technologies, AGT, Silver Spring, Maryland. And okay.
So it's a for-profit corporation, and you have investment capital and investors that you have to support. And that organization is acting as the sponsor And it may be directly manufacturing itself, or it may be subcontracting for the manufacturing. If it's a typical smaller startup type environment, it's probably subcontracting for the clinical trials, and for the, you may have engaged a regulatory affairs firm to assist you. You may have engaged a toxicology company, non-clinical or animal testing facility, et cetera, to do a lot of this work. But your firm accepts the responsibility of all of that because it is the sponsor. So the responsibility for whatever gets done through your subcontractors all flows up to this corporation that you just referred to.
Yes.
In the case of the emergency use authorized products, functionally, the Department of Defense and the FDA became the sponsor as a consequence of the utilization of the emergency use authorization pathway.
In the context of the COVID-19 2020.
Yeah. And what Pfizer and Moderna functionally, and this has been determined to be the case legally in the courts, Pfizer and Moderna functionally are contractors to the U.S. government or to the European Union or fill in the blank. And so in so doing, they are sitting within layers of indemnification. And at the top is the same basic logic that your corporation operates under. If one of those contractors that your corporation selects engages in malfeasance, the responsibility for that flows up to the corporation that you're affiliated with. And eventually to the CEO. That CEO can be held accountable.
That is true. But I must say, I'm very pleased, and so are the investors, with the acuity, the devil in the detail. There's been no sidestepping or overstepping of.
And as it should be the case, and I'm glad to hear that. And that's been part of my professional mission, frankly. And as a consultant, one of the value adds that I am known to bring to my clients is that often the C-suite people, chief science, chief operating, chief executive, find themselves surrounded by people that can tend to be a bit sycophant. And so they often sought me out as somebody known to be willing to tell it truthfully, no matter where the chips may fall. So that was part of the value that I brought to my clients traditionally. So it's no surprise that I would take the same attitude in speaking to the public. But you're right that you're implying appropriately that in this COVID situation, a lot of that went sideways. And there was an intentional suspension of the rules based on the logic that was packaged as Operation Warp Speed.
I must jump in there and ask you a question, Doctor. Was it, from a political, administrative, governing point of view, a necessary risk for Operation Warp Speed to take the risk of an overstep? Or might it be said that there were characters involved in advantaging themselves at the expense of the nation, and in the case of the pharmaceuticals, at the expense of the world, by pushing out something less than totally proven?
So both things can be true simultaneously.
Yeah.
And what, so we often think in dichotomies, it's either A or B, forgetting that often it can be A and B, all of the above. I often make the point, it's extremely difficult to differentiate between incompetence and nefarious intent. In the case of OWS, we have two key
players. OWS stands for?
Operation Warp Speed. We have two key players. One is named Peter Marks. Peter Marks is the head of the Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research, or CBER. which is the branch of the FDA responsible for vaccines, among other things. Peter Marks came to power at the FDA very rapidly advanced, based on his advocacy that the current portfolio of FDA regulations are overly burdensome, and they need to be streamlined and reduced. So that's been his selling point, basically, for his career advancement at FDA. He worked together with another gentleman who was in charge of an office three down from the president organizationally called the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response. And that individual, who had oversight responsibility for an organization called BARDA, which funded much of what happened during the COVID crisis, the big money, as did DOD to some extent. Those two were responsible for advocating within HHS and DOD that it was necessary to drop a lot of the normal rules and regulations because of the nature of the threat, which is the other part of what you were just speaking of. So in order to really start to tease apart what transpired, we have to ask the question, how did that threat assessment, which is the technical term, come to pass? And how was the consensus developed, I would argue groupthink developed, that led to the response which originally formed within the Trump administration and then was adopted, first rejected during the campaign by the Biden group and then embraced as soon as he became president and accelerated even further. So how did that take place? There was clearly a directed effort to represent the threat of SARS-CoV-2 as extreme. And that threat assessment was grossly overstated. That was in part due to the Imperial College in London and the laboratory of Neil Ferguson, a group that has chronically overstated risk of infectious diseases based on modeling, pure modeling. And that group made an early assessment that the case fatality rate for SARS-CoV-2 was about 3.4%. So about 3.5 out of every 100 people that got infected would die. That was the modeling. And based on that number, governments across the world overreacted. It turns out that Jay Bhattacharya had done some actual research early on at Stanford, for which he was vilified, where he actually established the case fatality rate experimentally by sampling people who were in line to have nasal swab diagnoses, finding out who was actually infected and what their true incidence fatality rate or case fatality rate was. And Jay estimated that at about 0.02%, which turns out to be pretty much the number. So what, early what was on.
What was the motivation to overstate?
So that's a key question. And as somebody trained as a expert witness by very skilled big law firms, I don't go there. Because I have this particular problem, I can't read minds. So I don't know what motivated Tony Fauci to do what he did and to misrepresent congressional testimony that there was no gain of function research, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know what motivated Neil Ferguson. It's usually money and power. There are a number of artifacts, let's say, surrounding this set of events, which undeniably include the largest upward transfer of wealth in modern history. enormous.
You're referring to the wealth to the pharmaceuticals.
It's not just the pharmaceutical industry. It's the financial industry. It's investors. It's the top fraction of a fraction of the economic ladder.
Well, how about the top fraction of your industry? Here's a book I'm reading now.
And I actually edited that book in detail twice when it was in draft form. So I'm highly familiar with it.
I'm very impressed with the level of detail. This is not a fast read. The book, folks, I was just showing Dr. Malone, he knows well, is The Real Anthony Fauci, written by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And as you can see, I'm about halfway through it here on my tag. But it's a damning text.
It's a damning text
that leaves no room to wiggle out from under.
Yeah.
And my concern, doctor, is that, and that drives back to my earlier question. You said, and your answer was, two things can be true at the same time. While it's true government may have overreacted in the spirit of trying to be responsive to a crisis, is it true that we complicated the matter by not letting natural immunity and natural factors take hold?
Well, more
which
than
drives
not,
to a question. Someone specifically asked me to ask you a question. What can people do who have taken the vaccine? How can they purge it from their system? Is COVID now worse than the flu or less worse than the flu? Could these people have suffered the same?
One at a time. okay, so let's talk about the vaccine long-term clearance issue.
Okay.
That was the first one you asked.
Yes.
We have multiple vaccines, so we need to kind of parse that a little bit. The adenovirus-based vaccines, which are no longer on the market, were actually more toxic. Not surprising, because they produced a large amount of protein in a short period of time. And understand that for the layperson listening to this, what these genetic therapy-based products, the adenovirus and the mRNA, both were originally designed for gene therapy purposes. Both Moderna and Pfizer's SEC disclosures indicate that both Pfizer and Moderna recognize that these are gene therapy technologies. So all of the denialism about this being a gene therapy technology is just propaganda, the fact checkers and all that. It's undeniable that that's what this is. This is the administration of genetic material into your body to cause your body to manufacture a foreign protein. That's gene therapy. And how would I know that that's what gene therapy is? Well, I'm actually a trained gene therapist, worked for one of the top gene therapists of the time, and I have the patents behind me to verify that, in fact, I was the original inventor of this technology, and I was working in a gene therapy lab at the time. So let's just put a stake in that. This is gene therapy, and it is applied to the indication of vaccines. That's what it is. There's a lot of different ways you could use a technology like this. Vaccines is one of the simplest and most straightforward. So that's what it is. It causes your body to manufacture a protein. The protein that it causes your body to manufacture is a protein that sits on the surface of this particular virus, and it has the name spike. It's kind of an unfortunate name, but that's because, you know, with the implications of a spiky thing. But that's the name. This is a coronavirus. That name comes from it looking kind of like the sun. We're going to have an eclipse soon, particularly in Texas. Many of you are aware of an eclipse. You know that when the moon slides in front of the sun, you see that bright halo around the sun. Okay, that's the corona or crown of the sun. And a coronavirus under an electron microscope looks kind of like that. And the crown part that sits around the sun when the moon slides in front of it is basically the spike proteins. That's where they are, is on the outside of that disc, or it's really a sphere. So what is spike protein in the context of SARS-CoV-2? I think it's completely now demonstrated that the spike protein in SARS-CoV-2 was genetically engineered through a collaboration between EcoHealth Alliance and the Wuhan Institute of Virology that was funded in part by the U.S. government, in large part by the U.S. government and various agencies in the U.S. government, but that the spike protein in SARS-CoV-2 was specifically genetically engineered. Okay, so it's a genetically engineered viral protein that has a furin cleavage site inserted into a specific place. It was predicted that it would be inserted in that place and described how it would be so inserted in a grant proposal that EcoHealth Alliance and Wuhan Institute of Virology submitted to the U.S. government. So there is that.
Is that the gain of function?
That is the gain of function, exactly. Okay, so that, as far as I'm concerned, and you can look up various segments of the series called Fallout, that I do with Yanya Kellick every Friday for Epic Times. And you'll see that we've covered this in depth, all the specifics, the citations, the nuances of the arguments, et cetera, are all there. You can find them. So this genetic therapy technology causes your body to produce the specific engineered protein that came out of the Wuhan lab. It has two minor alterations to make it even more immunogenic, but it is the engineered spike protein from the Wuhan Institute of Virology that your body is manufacturing for these vaccines.
So and gain of function was man-made and then is injected into the body in a way for the body to make it itself.
And they without apparent, you know, this is another one of those incompetence versus mullah or nefarious intent, for whatever reason. I can't get into their heads. For instance, the group at the Vaccine Research Center, the Dale and Betty Bumpers Vaccine Research Center at NIH in the NIAID, reporting to Tony Fauci, engineered this into the mRNA vaccine that was marketed by Moderna. And that spike protein is a toxin. It meets the criteria for what is a toxin. It is toxic to humans. It causes a variety of different effects, alterations in blood clotting, damage to myocardium, damage to central nervous system. It triggers autoimmune responses. It has a number of easily demonstrated toxic effects. Therefore, it is a toxin. That is the definition of what a toxin is. And you, as somebody who is well aware of toxicological research, understands that this is very straightforward. You know, a toxin is as a toxin does. Does it cause toxicity? And spike absolutely causes toxicity. One of the first key papers that demonstrated that toxicity came out of the Salk Institute, interestingly enough. Okay, so this just to put a pin in it, these genetic therapy-based technologies being utilized for vaccination purposes, ostensibly, cause patients' bodies to receive foreign genetic information, which causes your body and the cells in your body to manufacture a gain-of-function created toxin in your body, which has toxic effects. It also causes your immune system to respond to that protein, and by the way, to also attack any cell that makes that protein.
Okay, I hear you, and your points are, I'm digesting everything you're saying, but I have a problem. Gain of function research was something Anthony Fauci denied. The toxin you're talking about is part of this gain of function research.
Absolutely. It was the specific.
Well, someone's lying, doctor.
No, Tony Fauci was lying. Okay.
And
he gaslit Rand Paul. He attacked ridiculed, gaslit Rand Paul. Okay, that's what happened.
Is this, you said two things could be possible at the same time. In your writings, I've seen how you have grown concerned about government intent working offshore with certain procedures and practices outside, non-domestic, for the protection of this nation from a governance point of view, and that maybe some of those practices were looked into overseas and conducted overseas with an ultimate initial pure intention of protecting our democracy, our constitutional republic, where what went afoul, correct me if I'm wrong, is the use of this gain of function research not to go after the enemy, but rather to impose on ourselves. Maybe it was population control. Maybe it was a nefarious few thinking they could make a ton of money off of pharmaceutical.
So let's try to work through these things one at a time. So
okay.
So I've kind of laid out what is spike, and spike is one of the major causes of toxicity. You were talking about what can we do post jab to recover. So spike is very resistant to proteases, as are the blood clots that spike triggers. These are the rubbery, very hard clots typically, and they can exist in your microvasculature as well as your large vessels. They can form in the venous sinus in your brain. Okay, so these are the, people use various words, but these are the rubbery, they call them squid-like clots. So there's a number of types of toxicity, mechanisms of toxicity that spike causes. And the RNA itself, because of the pseudouridine, persists in your body for a long period of time. That has intrinsic toxicity. And the lipid nanoparticles have intrinsic toxicity. Some people, for whatever reason, as you know, in medicine, there's always a spectrum. Some people don't have any impact from a toxic product at a certain dose, and some people may be very sensitive to it. So what we observe in the case of the vaccine products, quote, vaccine products, is that some people experience some rather severe side effects. Some of those are autoimmune related, and this has been validated, Guillain-Barré syndrome, for example, but there are many others. And some of them are direct toxicity, such as the cardiotoxicity, and some of them are intermediate, such as the blood coagulation problems. Those are just three examples. And all three of those examples are validated in a major new study funded by CDC, published in Vaccine, funded to the tune of $10 million, involving over 99 million cases that were examined coming from government databases. So I'm not, you know, I'm checking off the fact checkers before they get at me here. So forgive that. So when you ask about what can somebody do to mitigate the effects of the product on their body after they've taken it, the problem is that there's a lot of different types and severity of toxicity. If you've developed blood clots in your brain or in your heart, or direct damage to your heart, heart doesn't heal, heart scars. And you're going to be dealing with that probably the rest of your life. And there's not much you can do. There's, being in biomedical research, there's a huge industry in trying to investigate cardiac stem cells and facilitate cardiac healing. And it's all pretty much come to naught. Billions of dollars invested. And I wish that that wasn't so, but it is. And unfortunately, this propaganda that the people that have experienced myocarditis, including unfortunately many young people, particularly young males, are just going to have a transient disease that they're going to heal from, and there's not going to be any long-term consequences. That's all propaganda. And you knew it was propaganda when they were saying it, because there hadn't been enough time to determine that that was truth. Okay, they were just talking out the top of their head, trying to keep people from panicking.
If I said that if people during COVID did not take the vaccine, would we have saved a million lives in this nation?
There are estimates that something in the range of 600,000 to 800,000 unnecessary deaths can be attributed to the combination of the vaccine and other public health, you know, poorly considered public health interventions.
So it's
complicated to sort all that out because you have suicide, yeah. You have an uptick in fentanyl, you have the economic damage, which is associated with any downturn in gross national product is associated with a surge in death, unnecessary death. So this is the excess all-cause mortality.
Yeah. So in the last 10 minutes, doctor, I want to move just a little faster on some of the points. If for all the people who have taken a vaccine,
yeah,
is there such a thing as being able to purge their system of the vaccine?
The answer is complicated. So I generally don't give medical advice over the internet as a licensed physician.
Observations based on fact.
What I'm comfortable saying is that I am somebody who's vaccine damaged. I took two doses of Moderna. My second dose happened to be one of the hot batches or bad batches. If you go to the website, how bad is my batch? I developed hypertension to 230 plus, so life-threatening hypertension, elevated heart rate, POTS syndrome, so my blood pressure would vary depending on how I was sitting or standing, restless leg syndrome, tinnitus, a number of other things that we now know are known side effects associated with those products. But at the time, no one really knew anything about that.
I
went through a detoxification protocol, which my physician crafted for me, which was largely based around the iRecover protocol published by the Frontline COVID Coalition, FLCCC, of Pierre Corey and Paul Merrick. So this included steroids, it included ivermectin. I continue to take on a daily basis natokinase, a protease that's known to be able to cleave spike and facilitate its processing. Spike is very resistant to most normal protein cutting enzymes that are called protease. So that's what I do and did. I also changed my diet. I was pre-diabetic and had gradually, I'm in my mid-60s. I built up my weight to over 190. I'm now down in the low 160s, and that's made a huge difference. So, and I now, at the time, I was not taking vitamin D and zinc. I do that now. So I have a much more rigorous a nutritional supplement schedule. I don't rely on any of these companies that sell, you know, miracle kits or whatever. I rely on a direct relationship with a skilled physician who understands early treatment. So that's what I've done. And depending on how severe your effects are, that kind of protocol may be sufficient for you.
Significant
neurologic damage, those people are very, very difficult to treat.
Oh boy.
And history is showing that they're not recovering. So the autoimmune disease, you can develop transverse myelitis and be paralyzed from these products.
And if you have suffered from that, is there any subsequent benefit for taking an ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine? I had COVID twice. I stayed away from vaccinations. I had a doctor who analyzed the situation and was not caught up in the mantra of things. And she gave me a ivermectin hydroxychloroquine mix with a little bit of zinc.
So in my
Z-Pak, I think it was.
Yeah. your Z stack, I think.
Yeah.
And you're referring to Zev Zelenko, which is really a derivative of work that was done in France. But in my case, I had a clear clinical response to ivermectin.
Good positive
clinical response to ivermectin for my symptoms.
And you measure that through the PCR antibody testing?
In terms of stamina, energy, fitness, that's been my experience. But that could just be, you know, I don't want to give people medical advice, but personally, in my situation, in two separate times where I've taken a course of ivermectin, I believe that I've had a strong positive clinical response.
Oh.
And I am compelled and convinced by the data summaries that the likes of Pierre Corey have developed that there is a clinical merit to ivermectin. And I had previously, together with my team, identified ivermectin as an antiviral back when we were doing drug repurposing research at Uniformed Services, University of Health Sciences.
You had recommended ivermectin.
Back, we'd identified actually written patents on ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine for use in things like yellow fever and Zika.
Were you heard? Was it adopted?
No, the company failed. We could not get investment capital for drug repurposing. So that's another story. Drug repurposing is just not seen by the venture capital community as a domain that merits investment capital.
Well, I must admit, doctor, I knew this was going to happen. We were going to hit the tip of the iceberg. You lit the match in the gas tank. The explosion just went off and I have 400 questions and I'm looking at my watch. I think we're out of time, but I do want you to know that I would be honored to have you back maybe for a second episode, and maybe we focus on a few points that are more salient. Ladies and gentlemen, I met Dr. Malone twice, actually, first at a CPAC convention where he was speaking, and then weeks later at a Council for National Policy on the West Coast, where I had the privilege of meeting him face to face, which was the precursor to this interview. But doctor, I don't understand. You've been very kind to focus on the medicine and the science in this interview, but I don't want to put you on the spot, and don't answer it if you don't want to, but I'm bothered by the extent to which government has overstepped in this case. I'm not anxious to blame it on Donald Trump. He was surrounded by people smarter than him in medicine and science that he allegedly was responding to. I'm more concerned about the subsequent and more obvious complicit behavior in this book that you had something to do with by Robert F. Kennedy, the real Anthony Fauci, where you can see firsthand the pharmaceuticals had an unprecedented historical financial gain on the delivery. Yeah,
there's no question about that. So when I finished working with Bobby on that book, the publisher asked me to write our own book, which you can find as The Lies My Government Told Me and The Better Future Coming. So that might be useful to you.
That's your book?
Yeah. And then you'll also find Bobby's next book on the Wuhan lab cover-up to be a good sequel to what you're reading right now.
And okay, for the folks listening and watching, would you repeat those two titles again, please?
So our book is called The Lies My Government Told Me and The Better Future Coming. And it's a very similar form factor and size to that book that you have right there. And then Bobby put out another one called The Wuhan Lab Cover-Up that really covers the arc of the history of the whole biowarfare, biodefense enterprise, beginning with really World War II. And that's also a shocker. And it goes even further into depth of what's transpired here.
Is it falling on deaf ears? Where's the disconnect?
It's falling on denialism. And there's a concerted propaganda campaign right now to deny the culpability of the government and the various players in the government in all of this. And that unfortunately will probably not be resolved by this election, because Donald Trump is, I wish it wasn't the case, but he is doubling down on his position that the vaccines were safe and effective and basically a major miracle that he facilitated. So whichever party gets in, Trump or Biden, I don't think that we're going to get to the bottom of this.
He was also talking about hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin. I forgot which, but he was bragging about having taken that.
Yeah, Peter Navarro. Well, he also took our drug. So he took a number of agents. He also took monoclonal antibodies. That famotidine was the agent that I had identified. But Peter Navarro, who was on point to source hydroxy for the nation and did so, by the way, just went to jail 2 days ago.
Yeah.
For here to testify.
What does that tell you?
I think he's another political prisoner, in my opinion. So yeah, I look forward to another chat where we can get into some of these deeper issues. And I've been writing about it extensively together with my wife, both in the book and now on Substack. So that's rwmalonemd.substack.com. You can follow us there. And in particular, now we write quite a bit about psychological warfare, cognitive warfare, and propaganda, which is what has enabled all of these various nefarious players to basically get away with the crime.
Yeah, you were talking, I think, about allowing propaganda in PSYOPs. I think there was some reference to that. And explaining this trusted news initiative and what they're putting out is...
Yep.
You had mentioned so many good points we had not discussed. Folks, if you're just joining us, you're a little late to the show. It's Dr. Robert Malone, an inventor, a scientist, a patent holder of several methods of cure or platforms of cure for various types of virus. And I wouldn't say he has the solution for COVID. In fact, I would suggest just the opposite's true. I think you became aware that these vaccines was research that became grabbed by the government and manipulated by large corporations.
And which was neither safe nor effective.
And therefore, how will society look at this in the future? Can we hide it forever? And is there no consequence for the wrongdoers?
I thought that the government was likely to resolve their dilemma with people becoming more aware of what's transpired by making some sacrificial lambs, specifically throwing Daszak and Fauci under the bus and blaming them and moving on. Instead, they seem to have denied that there was any problem at all, insisting that these products are fully safe and effective, and just trying to cover up the whole thing with a wall of denialism and propaganda.
Yeah.
And that's the way it's playing right now. I don't know what the long term is going to be in terms of humanity, but clearly we have a problem. I wrote an essay about, to try to close on a happier note, on Substack. Just yesterday, I published an essay about the importance of citizen journalism, which is what you're doing here. And that's why such a concerted propaganda, you know, algorithmic censorship, et cetera, campaign is ongoing right now, is because, and you'll appreciate this, Gene, I argue that citizen journalism is the most disruptive technology to occur since the printing press in the world of journalism, that's what's got the government and the oligopoly so upset right now.
Well,
is they
yeah.
cannot control the information stream anymore. And
well,
they're trying
it can be very good. It can be very bad. It can be salacious. I must admit to you and to those watching that I did a few hours of homework on Dr. Robert Malone after I met him in person about a month ago, just to make sure that this conversation today was rooted in truth and in facts. Ergo, our name, Grassroots Truthcast. I pride myself on working from facts, not fiction, emotion aside. And that's what you've done here today, Doctor. I'll take you up on your offer. Can we meet again to follow up with more? Because I would like to transcend away from the faux pas of the vaccination response, COVID-19, the last 2.5-3 years. I'd like to move towards this other concept you used called mass formation psychosis.
Yep.
The idea
so that's C.S. Desmond's work.
Desmond's word. You quoted it. Yeah, yep. You quoted Desmond, and I was very impressed with that. How we have, it's like the Overton window concept, yep. And the Desmond's word, the mass formation psychosis. I'd like to talk about how government is manipulating the citizens now, yep. To with a false narrative on, yep. What happened with COVID. Look what's happening right now as we speak with TikTok. I mean, they're, yep. Trying to, okay, I'm on board, get China out of TikTok, but I don't want to lose the right to free speech, which, right. which this forum represents,
and
between.
And you. Also what's going on in the Supreme Court right now in Missouri versus Biden.
Oh boy. Well, yeah, there, so, you go. There's our, yeah, agenda, so, for the, so, next episode.
That sounds great. And let's sign off for now, Gene. It's been a pleasure. And thanks for your patience.
Folks, thank you for joining us on another episode of Grassroots Truthcast. And thank you, Dr. Malone, for being with us today.
Okay.
Take care now.
I remember the first meeting that I had with our chief medical team. And I said to them, I said, life comes down, you're going to be judged by the choices that you make. And when the choice to start this company came up, it was a no-brainer. Because we all need to fight for what we believe in, and we need to strive for something.
I'm Dr. Heather Gessling. I'm a family medicine physician. I am the chief operating officer for the medical team at the wellness company. We strive to base all of our decisions on science, and the lack of unbiased science in the last 2 years is one of the catalysts that has brought about the wellness company.
My role in the wellness company is going to be largely one of education and re-education of our physician core, who are going to be administering medicine to large numbers of people, we hope, under our guidance. Okay, we are not going to be telling them how to practice, but we are going to be telling them how to approach the patient in a different way. And that way involves returning to the first principles of medicine, which are the basic sciences.
Myself and the wellness company rely on data, scientific data, to drive critical decisions. But importantly, we must consider all available sources of data. Everything's on the table. Nutrition is basically what we put in our bodies. And you can imagine what we put in our bodies really matters. And nutrition science is going to play a giant role in the data-driven decisions and treatment plans that we devise at the wellness company.
So I'm Dr. Jen Vandewater. I'm a doctor of pharmacy. I graduated pharmacy college in 2006. I worked mostly for retail pharmacies. And through the years, I noticed that it became very robotic. The pharmacy industry was no longer about patient care, and it became more fill prescriptions, give shots, anything you could do just to keep busy. There was no time for patient interaction and patient well-being. But while I was there, I was still seeing that people were on lots and lots and lots of medications. So as I was watching doctors prescribe more and more, I thought, well, how can I assist and help the patient realize they may be on too many medications?
Current medical practice is so completely off the rails that it almost has to be destroyed and rebuilt from the ground up, because we have allowed ourselves to be taken over by pharma for the most part. Most doctors just prescribe. They treat numbers as opposed to patients. They don't reverse disease. They maintain chronic disease. This is all wrong. Our approach is wrong. Our approach to these diseases is wrong. It is all based on giving a pill to treat a number. That is what modern medicine has become. We are not treating patients, we are treating numbers.
It's always been said that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And if we can prevent an illness, we can prevent suffering, potentially hospitalization, progression of disease, and death. So prevention is absolutely critical.
I see creating an integrated healthcare system that focuses on prevention versus being reactive. I see a company that's going to continue to have amazing products and put third-party products in our store and in our platform that are vetted by some of the best physicians in the world.
What makes the wellness company's approach unique is that we're coming at different angles. We're not just coming into one area of health, we're coming into education. We're coming into training even providers on what health actually looks like. We've been kind of confused and misguided through the years, so the wellness company is hitting it in a way that nobody else has hit it before.
We have to go back to treating patients and getting them healthy again and maintaining that state of good health.
I truly am inspired to leave the world a better place than I came in. I want to create that change. I want to help people.
Grow in what you know about your health. Your health is yours. You own your body. We want to just guide you in that so that you can make the right decisions for your health. And I'm excited to tell you that we're here and we're bringing you the best.